to the Hanover Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hanover Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue tracing the events in modern history, events God orchestrated to bring Israel to formal statehood in 1948. Pastor Bob will begin discussing the Arab refugee problem. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hanover Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 12. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
We now begin lesson 12 of our class, The First Regathering, Modern Israel. I look at the modern Zionist movement and the establishment of the modern State of Israel in 1948. We have now completed our investigation into Zionism proper when we came through 1947, late 1830s through 1947, a study of about 100 years. And we now have begun the actual study of the modern State of Israel in 1948 with the War of Independence. Right now, the War of Independence is raging, and we're about ready to take a look at the Arab refugee problem that was created in 1948. So there were changes in the configuration of Israel at that time, geographic and political changes in the configuration of Israel, but there were also demographic changes as well. Demography is the study of human populations. It's the study of the size, growth, density, distribution, vital statistics of human populations. So there was a demographic change as well. Now the first of two phases began. In the months immediately following the partition resolution, approximately 30,000 Arab people decided to leave Palestine. This is immediately following the partition resolution. Most of these immigrants were businessmen and their families, and most of them lived in the larger cities. That was the first phase of the demographic shift. The second phase took place in April and May of 1948. As the Jewish community began to secure the upper hand in Palestine, Arab public services collapsed in the pandemonium of British evacuation. And so now the exodus of Arab families resumed. But this time it included large numbers of communal officials, of village mayors, of qadis, which are Muslim priests, and judges. Thousands of fellaheen. A fellaheen is a peasant or agricultural laborer in an Arab country. Thousands of fellaheen and town dwellers began to accompany them. Now, there are various reasons for the flight, but none of the reasons for the flight can be traced to an alleged appeal for the evacuation by the Arab governments themselves. Now, this appeal ostensibly was to make way for the impending Arab invading armies of the Arab countries. Now, this was a frequently repeated Israeli claim after the war, that the Arab governments appealed for evacuation. And an example of this is seen in an article that I'd like to read by a well-established and a very reliable Christian ministry in their magazine. And you read this column in this article, and I quote, "Arab heads of state had warned repeatedly that if the Jewish agency exercised their right to proclaim a new nation, then the Jews would be pushed into the sea by the Arab juggernaut poised at the borders. These Arab leaders had repeatedly told civilian Arabs living near Jewish areas to abandon their homes, assuring them that they could return to them after the sure Jewish bloodbath. The voluntary Arab exodus had begun. Hundreds of thousands had already left their homes in Jaffa, Haifa, Lydda, Ramla, and parts of Jerusalem." Now, this is the frequently reported Israeli claim after the war. However, according to Howard Sachar in his book, there No such order for evacuation was ever found in any release of the Arab League or in any military communique of the period. Rather, the evidence cited by Howard Sakhar in his book is that the evidence in the Arab press and in the Arab radio at the time was to the contrary. By and large, the Arab League ordered the Palestinians to stay where they were, and stringent punitive measures were reported against Arab youths of military age who fled the country. Even Jewish broadcasts in Hebrew mention these Arab orders to remain. So Abdullah and the various national committees appealed repeatedly to the Arabs not to leave their homes. In Ramallah, the commander of the Arab Legion threatened to confiscate the property and blow up the houses of those Arabs who left without permission. At one point, the Lebanese government decided to close its frontiers to all Palestinians, except women, children, or the aged. Now, the most obvious reason for the mass exodus was the collapse of Palestine Arab political institutions. These institutions collapsed upon the flight of the Arab leadership. When the Arab leadership left, the institutions collapsed. And they collapsed at the time when this leadership and their institutions were most urgently needed. So the departure of mukhtars and judges and the like from Haifa and from the new city of Jerusalem, from Jaffa, Safed, and elsewhere, dealt a grave blow to the Arab population. The Arab society was semi-feudal in character, and so this rendered the illiterate fellaheen almost entirely dependent on the landlord. Once this was gone, the Arab peasant was terrified by the likelihood of remaining in an institutional and cultural void. And of course, Jewish victories obviously intensified the fear and accelerated their departure. Now, after hostilities ended, the UN placed a number of Arab fugitives from the Arab-controlled, from the Israeli-controlled territory at approximately 720,000. Approximately 70% of the Arab population fled. Jewish estimates were 538,000, so there's quite a disparity between the two. 180,000 refugees fled toward the Gaza area. And the fate of these Gaza derelicts, these Gaza refugees, was particularly cruel. They were refused employment and resettlement by Israelis and Egyptians alike. And for the next generation, they were destined to vegetate in confinement in refugee camps, in a confinement as tragic as that endured by Jewish displaced persons in Europe between 1945 and 1948, and that refugee situation continues. The Palestinian refugees are not allowed out of their refugee camps. The refugee camps are a tragic place to be housed. And now we come to the second UN truce. The UN Security Council unanimously endorsed a second ceasefire proposal on July 15th with instructions for hostilities to cease in 3 days. By July 18th, the UN Security Council unanimously endorsed a second ceasefire proposal on July 15, July 15, with instructions that the hostilities would cease in 3 days. By July 18th, 3 days later, Israel occupied far more of the land than the UN partition resolution had allocated, while the Arabs occupied only one Jewish settlement, and that was Mishmar HaYarden, as well as a small Egyptian foothold in the Negev. The next phase was to liberate the Negev. Now, the majority of Negev settlements, they were not captured but remained under Egyptian blockade. It was agreed that the Egyptian danger was potentially the greatest, and that the priority from then on should be given to a full-scale offensive in the Negev. In preparation for the new offensive, Israeli transport planes ferried men and material to an airstrip carved out in the northern Negev desert. from August until late October 1948. Some 2,000 tons of equipment and 1,900 troops were carried down in this fashion. Under cover of darkness, the soldiers infiltrated into the Negev kibbutzim, and pretty soon a full Israeli brigade was operating behind Egyptian lines. During the same period, Yigdal Alon slowly moved his veteran northern brigade southward. By mid-October, the young commander had 30,000 troops at his disposal on a single front. He had a small air fighter squadron as well, and he was impatient to get the offensive underway. Well, the opportunity for him came on October 14th. With UN approval, the Israelis set out to provision their settlements by conducting an unarmed convoy across Egyptian-controlled territory. The moment the column drew within sight of the farms, the lead vehicles were blown to bits. Now, the fact, undetected by UN observers, was that the Israelis themselves had dynamited the trucks. And armed with that pretext, the pretext that the Egyptians had done it, Alon went into action immediately. The speed with which he now launched his offensive was a shattering surprise to the Egyptians. Soon the major concentration of Egyptian troops in the Negev, approximately 35,000 men, faced the possibility of defeat or entrapment. The British introduced a resolution into the Security Council demanding another Palestine ceasefire, and the measure was adopted. During the next week of October 22nd, the UN truce gradually settled on the desert, and the Egyptians began evacuating units from the western Negev. And now let's come to the final. Let's take a look at the final campaign of the War of Independence. As 1948 drew to a close, the Israelis were making preparations to attack and eradicate the Egyptian army's last remaining garrison in Israeli territory. The purpose was to establish the irrefutable fact of Israel's sovereign power and viability, and to end the war altogether. The objective became Al-Aoujah, the anchor of Egyptian positions in the Negev Desert. If Al-Aoujah fell, it would break the back of the Egyptian military effort. This target was well protected by sizable Egyptian military and tank units, and so a direct assault was hardly feasible. Yadin discovered a solution in his archaeological guide to Greco-Roman Israel. An ancient Roman road ran to the south of Al-Aoujah. Now, under the cover of darkness, engineers repaired the most difficult stretches on this ancient route of march. The work was completed in uncanny silence, such uncanny silence that the Egyptian outposts, less than 2 miles away, remained completely unsuspecting. They didn't hear a thing. On the night of December 22nd, the offensive began. A column of half-tracks and troop carriers moved along the Roman road. At dawn, December 26th, the Israelis were within firing range. The Israelis were able to attack the defenders from behind. Although stunned, the Egyptians fought back courageously. After a full day and night of close-quarter fighting, they surrendered. Their colonel was still in his pajamas. The surprise attack caught him in bed. Israel went on to conduct raids across the international border into the Sinai itself. So the Jewish community, the Israelis, had come far further in 8 months of war than the limited distance of mere geographical advance. In May, their ill-armed little militia had faced Egyptian tanks only 16 miles from Tel Aviv. In December, just a number of months later, in December, their battle-seasoned troops, supported by armor and fighter planes, were driving into Egypt, and they were cutting the last exit routes of the Egyptian army. Help, however, came to distraught Egypt. Under the terms of the 1936 Anglo-Egyptian Treaty, Britain was obligated to assist Egypt in the event of an attack from an outside party. On December 29th, the Security Council, the UN Security Council, ordered an immediate ceasefire in Israel. It called for a permanent armistice in all sectors of the area. And now was Britain's chance to revive its presence in the area. London chose this moment to deliver a warning. Unless Israel obeyed the Security Council resolutions, it would employ its forces in accordance with the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty. This was an ultimatum, and it was a chilling one. Ben-Gurion didn't dare risk a confrontation with a great power. Yadin agreed, and the Israeli armed forces had won too much to gamble on their victory now. On January 2, 1949, orders reached Yigdal Alon to withdraw his men from the Sinai. Now we move into 1949 and ceasefire agreements with Egypt, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. In January of 1949, initial discussions opened between Israel and Egypt on the island of Rhodes. As the first step, the armistice agreement was drawn on the basis of the existing military lines. Once Egypt, which was the greatest Arab power, once Egypt had agreed to a treaty with the Jews, it was difficult, much less difficult for the others to follow. So after agreements with Egypt, agreements with Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan were all signed by July 20th. Iraq. Iraq was the only Arab belligerent not to sign an armistice agreement directly with Israel. So the agreements left Israel in possession of approximately 8,000 square miles of land, or 21% more land than was allotted under the UN partition plan. Israel then applied for membership in the UN. Following the Rhodes Armistice Agreements, Israel's application for membership in the UN was approved by the Security Council on March 11, 1949. The membership itself came in May. In those days, admission to the world body was considered meaningful evidence of a nation's sovereign viability. As the Israeli flag was ceremonially hoisted in the plaza of the General Assembly building, the Jewish world at large asked themselves whether only 4 years had passed since the Star of David had been identified primarily as the seal of doom worn on concentration camp inmates. And now it was flying over the General Assembly plaza, the Star of David, a seal, a symbol of the new state of Israel, no longer a seal of doom worn by concentration camp inmates. David Ben-Gurion was elected the Prime Minister of Israel, and Chaim Weizmann became the first President of Israel. In addition, the first Knesset opened in 1949. Now, in the 18 months following the Declaration of Independence, some 340,000 Jewish people arrived in Israel, and no influx like it had been witnessed in modern times. Israel issued an open-door policy to all Jewish people. Emotionally, the policy was dictated by the most fundamental of Zionist tenets. The philosophy extended back to the biblical promises, and it extended forward to the commitment in the Declaration of Independence that Israel, quote, will be open to the immigration of Jews from all countries of the dispersion. There was another less valid, or should I say no less valid, explanation for the unprecedented policy, the unprecedented open-door policy, and this was the government's need of an instant population. People were needed to deepen the military manpower, to deepen the military manpower reserve, to settle the empty spaces of the land, to start new agricultural colonies, to create a modernized economy. The Yemenites were the first to reinforce their numbers in Israel. Now, Yemen lies on the southwestern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. It was the home of 50,000 Jewish people. Now, these Yemenites traced their presence in Yemen to the mass dispersion from the Holy Land after the Roman suppression. Their status was that of a barely tolerated minority. And this status as a barely tolerated minority was the result of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century. But somehow they held fast to their Jewish traditions, and they continued to live in the unshakable expectation of the arrival of the Messiah. They believed he would lead God's people back to the land of Israel. With Israel's independence in 1948, life in Yemen suddenly became extremely dangerous. Chagrined at the defeat of Arab forces, aroused by the opportunity to loot, bands of Muslims swarmed through the Jewish community, plundering and burning. And so departure became a matter of survival. The Jewish Agency became involved, and the largest numbers of Yemeni Jews made their way on foot southward to the coast. There, they were loaded onto American DC-4 transport aircraft and flown to Israel. This airlift was known as Operation Magic Carpet. And at the peak of the airlift, at the peak of Operation Magic Carpet, planes were flying around the clock, 7 or 8 flights a day, transporting 200 people per plane load. Round the clock schedule, 7 to 8 flights a day, 200 people per load. Well, let's come to 1950, and the Western powers guarantee the existing borders in the Middle East. Now, the preamble of the Rhodes Armistice Agreements made impressive and encouraging reading. The preamble stated that it was designed to facilitate the transition from truce to permanent peace. Each belligerent endorsed a Security Council injunction against the use of force. Each belligerent affirmed Israel's and the Arab nation's right to security and freedom from attack. However, in spite of such high-sounding statements, the Arab countries adopted a hostile policy toward Israel. The Arab purpose was single-minded and all-absorptive. It was flatly committed to the destruction of Israel as an independent state. The armistice agreements were originally to be one phase of a twofold effort under United Nations auspices to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. By the terms of the General Assembly resolution of December 11, 1948, a Palestine Coalition Commission was established and charged with three major tasks. Number one, the establishment of a binding peace between Israel and its Arab enemies. Number two, the facilitation of measures to repatriate and resettle Palestinian refugees. And three, the formulation of a plan to organize a permanent international regime in Jerusalem. Well, as matters developed, the PCC, the Palestine Conciliation Commission, failed to achieve any of these goals. And subsequently, the Arab nations adopted a fourfold strategy against the young nation of Israel. The Arabs attempted to strangle Israel's capability to survive or to grow through the use of number one, economic boycott, number two, through blockade, number three, diplomatic isolation, and number four, border violence. So the region was unstable, the region was ripe for war. Now the West took the first decisive action to restore stability to the Middle East. In May of 1950, the United States, Britain, and France issued a declaration, and I quote, "Should the three governments find that any one of these states, Israel or its Arab neighbors, should the three governments find that any one of these states contemplates violating the frontiers of armistice lines, they will act both within and without the framework of the United Nations in order to prevent such a violation," unquote. So this gesture reflected Western self-interest because it was primarily designed to block Soviet penetration into the area. But it was gratefully welcomed by most Israelis. Let's take a look at the law of return. The first Knesset passed a law of return in July 1950, investing Jews everywhere with the legal right of immigration to Israel. In David Ben-Gurion's words, and I quote, "This is not only a Jewish state where the majority of the inhabitants are Jews, but it is a state for all Jews, wherever they are, and for every Jew who wants to be here. This right is inherent in being a Jew," end quote. Well, this is impressive language, but for all this impressive language, the law of return did not grant citizenship. In 1952, the Knesset passed a nationality law that accomplished that particular purpose. Under the 1952 bill, Israeli nationality might be acquired four ways. Number one, by immigration. Number two, by birth. Number three, by residence. Or by naturalization. Number four, naturalization. Now, the law of return likewise failed to define the term Jew. And the Supreme Court accordingly made its first effort to define this national term in the Brother Daniel case. At the time of the Brother Daniel case, the law of return stated that a Jew was anyone born of a Jewish mother. Now, what is the Brother Daniel case? In 1962, Oswald Rufusen, a Jewish convert to Roman Catholicism, who had risked his life saving dozens of Jews from the Nazis, attempted aliyah, attempted immigration under the law of return. He declared himself a Jew by birth and a Roman Catholic by religion. He was turned down by the Ministry of the Interior. He appealed to the High Court of Justice, the Bagatz. But his appeal was rejected on the grounds that the Jew in the street would not consider this Catholic monk known as Brother Daniel as Jewish. That's the main import of the Brother Daniel case. The immigration from Yemen, remember we talked about the immigration from Yemen? The immigration from Yemen soon followed and ultimately was surpassed by a massive airlift from Jews in Iraq. That great airlift was known as Operation Ali Baba. It was launched in May 1950. By the time it ended in December 1951, 113,000 passengers had flown to the Jewish state. Afterwards, smaller numbers of Jews reached Israel via Iran, and this brought the total Iraqi immigration to 121,000. In 1951, the second Knesset was elected. Tension on the border continued, and so did immigration. As we come to the year 1956, we come to the Sinai Campaign. For the better part of two decades, from the summer of 1952 until the autumn of 1970, the history of the Arab world was largely dominated by Gamal Abd al-Nasser. Nasser was an officer in the Egyptian army. The Egyptian army, on July 23, 1952, seized control of Egypt's government in a bloodless coup, ousting King Farouk. In March of 1954, Nasser became premier, and later he would assume the presidency. In 1955, Nasser began exploring the possibilities of obtaining military equipment from the Soviet bloc. Moscow was very open to this. It was prepared to exploit any opening that would undermine Western influence in the Middle East. Moscow made no effort thereafter to disguise its hostility to Israel. Moscow repeatedly condemned the Jewish state in the Security Council and accused Ben-Gurion of preparing for war against the Arabs. The nation's limited resources clearly dictated a military force based essentially upon reserves. And the Knesset enacted a comprehensive defensive service law that established the legal foundation of Israel's citizen army. And in the 1950s, mobilization had already become an integral part of Israel's everyday life. In short, every Israeli was a soldier on either active or reserve status. In December of 1953, Moshe Dayan was appointed chief of staff, and under his able leadership, the army became a hard-hitting, aggressive force. I see we're coming to the end of our time on this lesson, so let's bring the lesson to a close at this point in time, and we'll pick it up in 1953 with the beginning of the Sinai Campaign and what eventually occurred through the years 1953 through, I believe it is 1956. So let's call the class to a close. We'll pick it up again with class number 13.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Heart of Our Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.